Hello everyone, welcome to History of Asia. For those who listen for the first time, the main thing you should know about this show is that we explore Iran's history anti-chronologically. This way, it's easier to understand why the events under scrutiny still matter. In the last episode, we saw how the lands in and around Iran were taken over by a Turkmen Sufi cult known as the Safavids. Under the impulse of their vicious leader Ismail, they forcibly converted the population to Twelver Shiism, which is still the state religion today. So this had pretty profound consequences. Now, as important as it may be, at first sight, it looks as if the rise of the Safavids, as well as their radical policies, were just freak accidents of history. But were they? Today, we'll see that these events may not have been as random as they first appear. Turks or Turkmens taking over parts of the Middle East and absorbing Persian culture, that was the norm, not the exception. There was a foundation for Shiite learning already in place, on which the Safavids could build, and the whole period was a high watermark of Sufism more broadly. In fact, there were other movements active in the region that look amazingly similar to Ismail's Safavids in almost any respect. In the series on Arabia, we saw that in the decades after the death of Muhammad, there arose a dispute over the position of the caliph. The Shiites supported Ali, but his opponent Muawiyah emerged on top and founded the Umayyad dynasty, which was also the first Muslim dynasty ever. The Umayyads managed to expand the Islamic realm further, until 750 when they fell victim to an insurgency. They were then replaced by the Abbasids, the last caliphate that encapsulated practically all Muslim lands. The Abbasids would hold out in one form or another for no less than half a millennium. In 1258, Baghdad was destroyed by the Mongols, and the last Abbasid caliph rolled into a carpet and trampled to death. But the Abbasids had lost much of their power long before that time. There are multiple reasons for this, but much had to do with the sheer size of their domain. It spanned an area from northwest Africa all the way into Central Asia. The question that soon plagued the Abbasids, therefore, was how does one keep control over such distant lands, in a time in which a message could travel no faster than a horse? Soon enough, governors became independent in all but name. To create a counterforce, the Abbasids used Turkic slaves. Why Turks? Well, first of all, they were heathens, which was a precondition for their enslavement. Further, they had no power base within the Muslim realm, so they could be expected to be loyal to the caliph. And last but not least, they had a reputation of being extraordinary fighters. But as we've said before in this show, that which you use to control, that inevitably controls you. The Turks took power themselves and built their own dynasties. These were the so-called sultans, whose name signifies raw power, power without legitimacy. Now, of course, they looked for ways to appear legitimate, and therefore they kept posing as faithful subjects of the caliph. They put him on the coins they minted and expanded their territories in his name. In reality, however, they more or less did as they pleased. Some even went so far as to wage war on the caliph to force him to accept their allegiance. They were servants of the caliph in the same way as minister means servant of the people. It sounds good, but don't take it too seriously. In their search for legitimacy, the emirs and sultans had other tools at their disposal besides the caliph's blessing, particularly Sufism and Persian culture. Let's start with the latter. The rebellion that brought the Abbasids to power was centered on the eastern provinces. The raw manpower that was needed for the power grab came from eastern garrisons. These comprised the most experienced and hardened soldiers in the whole Muslim realm. These men were used to fighting the scary heathens of Central Asia. But just as important were the elites of Iran and Mesopotamia. These considered themselves the proud inheritors of the bureaucratic and intellectual tradition of the Sasanian Empire, and therefore as the natural leaders of the region. There are reasons for feeling this way. The Arabs, and later the Turks, had no comparable bureaucratic or scholarly tradition of their own, so it was only natural that they sought the help of Persian administrators and intellectuals. but to their frustration, the latter increasingly felt frozen out of power by the Umayyads. Their resentment played an important role in the overthrow of that dynasty. They would organize the Abbasid Caliphate. The new dynasty fully embraced the Persian Mesopotamian court culture. Political manuals from the pre-Islamic period provided guidance. As for the Persian language, unlike other tongues, Persian was never totally supplanted by Arabic. This is fascinating to me and hard to grasp. Why does one language survive or adapt to change while others wither away? It must be that they're subject to Darwinian dynamics like most anything else. But since a language is all about human conventions, I find it hard to see how one could be more adaptable than the other. When does a word or a phrase stop belonging to, say, the Arabic species anyway? I don't have any answers, I just find it fascinating to think about. I've heard, for instance, that it is thanks to its loose grammar that Persian lends itself to the absorption of vocab from other languages better than others. Now, in theory, adaptability is supposed to be good for survival. But ironically, few languages will have changed so little over the last 1,000 years as Persian. By the early Abbasid era, although Persian had absorbed some Arab loanwords, as well as the Arabic script, it was still alive and kicking. And this new Persian is still more or less in use today. That is to say, Iranians can still understand poems from 1,000 years ago. They learn them at school, and a large proportion of the population can cite them from memory. That is astounding, I think, almost unique perhaps. For comparison, the few texts that have survived in Old Dutch are really hard to understand. Just one sentence from a poem may make this clear. In English it reads, "All birds have started to build nests except you and me." In modern Dutch, it sounds like this: "Alle vogels zijn nesten begonnen behalve jij en ik." And in the original, "Hebben alle wagelas nestas hugnas hinase hik en datu." I have no idea how to pronounce it, and that says something right there. To me, it looks like a Latin dish with a little mop of Dutch mayonnaise on top. By contrast, a Persian poem from the same period is still perfectly readable for modern Iranians. If languages were indeed like animals, is Persian perhaps like the shark or the turtle, something that hardly seems to evolve at all, and yet that thrives in the most diverse circumstances? If so, then what accounts for that? Now, I don't speak a word of Farsi, and I prefer historical explanations to linguistic ones anyway, so let's look in that direction, shall we? After the early Muslim conquests, Iran received far fewer Arab immigrants than places like Iraq or Syria. And those who did come didn't build new cities there, like Fustat in Egypt or Kufa in Iraq. Instead, they mingled among a mass of Persians and were absorbed by them eventually. What also played a role was that there was pride associated with the language. Arabic was introduced for certain purposes, above all religion, as it was the language of the Quran, of course, but Persian always continued to be used in other contexts, like poetry, for example. This was a multilingual society. Perhaps the language's resilience is testament to how literate the Iranian people were, as they still are, and how proud of their heritage. If so, that may have to do with the rich imperial tradition dating back to biblical times. Now, the fact that the rogue governors and the sultans lacked legitimacy didn't mean they didn't care about their image. On the contrary, like a nerd that craves to be accepted by the cool kids, they overcompensated. Men with small reproductive organs tend to buy red sport cars, don't they? The emirs and the sultans, for their part, tried to say, "Look at how cultured, how devout I am." So they tried to outdo the caliph in patronizing artists, scholars, and last but not least, poets. In so doing, they helped fortify and spread the Persian culture and language. Turkic invaders entered the Islamic realm through Persianate lands anyway, and they expanded from there. Take the Ghaznavids, for example. These started their careers as slave soldiers in the service of a Persia-centered dynasty. After they broke loose, they ventured into northern India, taking the Persian culture of their former masters with them. Hence, the Sultanate of Delhi had a Persian court culture, as would its successor, the Mughal Empire. So from the Middle Ages until the 19th century, Persian culture set the tone from Turkey to India. Perhaps the most important recipients of patronage were the ulama. Starting around the end of the first millennium, these became organized in madrasas. Until then, the study and teaching of Islamic law had been the work of individuals who were recognized as experts. Once Islamic study was organized around madrasas, however, the ulama could develop a more solid judicial framework. And that was necessary given the growing complexity of the state and the importance of Islamic law in it. This came in handy for the new rulers as well. By sponsoring these institutions, they showed themselves to be exemplary Muslims. So did ordinary people, by the way, as handouts to religious trusts were exempt from tax and confiscation, even if they only came into force after the death of the donor. Not unimportant in a time of predatory states. Because of all this sponsoring, a career in Islamic law became financially appealing. Now, you often hear that if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. But if you pay a lot, you might attract people who are into it for the wrong reasons. This is fine, perhaps, as long as you're looking for a trader or a soccer player. But it's not okay if you want people who lecture others about righteousness, piety, and yes, humility. This may be why around the same time as the madrasa schools, there emerged the Sufi cults. The word Sufi refers to the woolen cloth that some chose to wear as token of their detachment. In the words of the Sufi poet Rumi, the biggest idol is your own ego. This whole attitude was a slap in the face of an all too comfortable establishment. And never was this criticism more effective than if the Sufi master in question was the respected ulama himself, as was often the case. The most well-known example is the Persian Al-Ghazali. He was one of the most famed scholars of Islamic law of his period. He made a very nice living for himself, was widely admired, and enjoyed the support of the Sultan. But at some point, it seems that he started to feel bad about this. He had no doubt about the quality of his work, but what about his motives? Was he doing it for Allah, or for the money, the prestige, and the influence that it gave him? In his autobiography, he writes about how he went through a crisis of conscience and how it led him to give up his lucrative position and become a wandering Sufi. Now, there may be more to this than meets the eye. It's not a mere coincidence that the rise of Sufism coincided with the era of Turkic overlords. Take the Seljuks, for instance, Al-Ghazali's sponsors. These were not slave warriors gone rogue, like the Ghaznavids. The Seljuks entered the Middle East as an invading nomadic army. They came from the steppes of Central Asia, where they had converted to Islam at some point in the recent past. Sufism had most likely been instrumental in their conversion. Sufis emphasized charismatic leadership. They had to follow their master in everything. He was the guide in their quest for God. This attitude suited the Turkic Khans very well. Apart from that, the Turks had only partially abandoned shamanism, and Sufism allowed them to continue some of their ritual customs within the boundaries of Islam. Most ulama were not so open-minded, however, and this created tension. The new rulers didn't appreciate being called heretics, of course, and the locals, including the ulama, didn't want them for their enemy. So both had an interest in reconciliation. No one would do more to bring this about than Al-Ghazali. He went to great pains to soften the criticism of Sufism. He stated that Islam could be experienced in several different ways, and that the Sufi testimonies about such things as oneness with God should be interpreted metaphorically. The fact that Al-Ghazali was perhaps the most respected jurist of them all, that put him in an ideal position to do this. In the same way that only an anti-communist hawk like Nixon could go to China to mend fences. Partly thanks to Al-Ghazali, Sufis were almost universally accepted as Muslims, until recently at least. Had this not been the case, some might have broken away from the Islamic community altogether. Now that may seem far-fetched perhaps, but the Baha'i and the Jews have done precisely that. If this had happened with the favorite Sufi cults of the Turkic elites, that would have been bad for Islamic scholars, but also for political stability. Instead, from the 12th century onward, most Sufi cults were part of the mainstream and contributed to order. Like the first ulama, the first Sufis were wandering loners who lived on handouts, most of all from people who sought their counsel. In such uncertain times, many were looking for spiritual guidance. As the saying goes, there are no atheists in foxholes. Over time, some Sufi masters would gain a large following. A hardcore of students became full-time devotees, blindly following their master's instructions. Their practices, by the way, ran the gamut from silent contemplation to ecstatic dancing. Some of these students married into the master's household. Others would attach themselves to the order in looser ways, for instance, by visiting the Sufi shrine to pray to saints or to pay their respects to their ancestors. Still others visited only once or twice, but participated in an initiation ceremony. Like in a parish where you also have some who are present every Mass, while others only come on Christmas Eve or for funerals. But all are in a way connected to the same religious community. In an individualistic and prosperous society like present-day Belgium, these ties tend to be weak, but in the time of Al-Ghazali, people needed mutual help and protection more than ever. The state was not going to help or protect them, so they would flock together. Sufi masters were the ideal people to guide them, for rulers often respected and patronized them. Like the bishops in Western Europe after the fall of Rome, they could exact concessions from the conqueror of the day, in return for a blessing, or at least for an encouragement to obey. As mediators, the Sufi sheikhs could gain a pivotal political position. Al-Ghazali famously declared that the position of the Sultan was just as valid as that of the Caliph, and that Muslims were not entitled to overthrow a Sultan who was unworthy or even sinful. Music to the ears of his sponsors, no doubt. Perhaps Al-Ghazali's turn to Sufism was indeed the result of a crisis of conscience, but some might say that it had a streak of opportunism about it too. Some Sufi orders even gained great political influence, becoming the exclusive creed of military movements. The Safavids were not so rare in this regard. The Ottoman Janissaries had their own favorite cult, for example. It's ironic, I think, that a movement that was meant to be all about self-denial and humility became the route to fame, power, and riches. It reminds one a bit of early Protestantism. Luther started this movement by condemning the abuses within the church. The root of the problem for him was that the clergy had a monopoly on reading the Bible and that they mistranslated it to serve their own avarice. So Luther translated the Bible into the vernacular and he encouraged all to read it for themselves. What's more, he insisted that any man's interpretation was as good as that of the Pope himself. Now, at first sight, this viewpoint has huge emancipatory potential. But it didn't take long for some extremist Protestants to claim that God had revealed to them, personally, the true hidden meaning behind the holy words. And some of these self-proclaimed prophets then started their own political movements, sometimes violent ones, in which blind obedience to the prophet was requested. Sometimes they authorized practices that were explicitly forbidden by the Bible. But that didn't matter, you see, because they could supposedly read between the lines. Perhaps the biblical authors were just being ironic sometimes, who knows? Once you open that Pandora's box, very strange things can come out. As we saw in the last episode, the early Safavids drank a lot and even performed cannibalistic rituals. It doesn't get much more heterodox than that, I suppose. Al-Ghazali accepted that there were multiple valid ways of practicing Islam, but he didn't mean that anything goes. On the contrary, he warned that all Muslims should be careful to stay within the bounds of Islam. Al-Ghazali recognized that certain lines in the Quran should be taken literally, while others had to be read as metaphors. Now, if you read something literally while you should look for a deeper meaning, or the other way around, that was sinful. But how could you know how to read this or that line? Who could be the judge of that? Well, the man for the job, according to Al-Ghazali, was Al-Ghazali. Surprise, surprise. In many ways, he was not at all tolerant towards heterodox beliefs. That's why I feel a bit like his turn to Sufism was like Nixon going to China. Nixon hadn't become tolerant towards communism,
infected, he wanted to make friends with the Chinese because he hoped to isolate the Soviet Union. Al-Ghazali's greatest targets were people who liked to apply the concepts and methods of Greek philosophy to interpretations of holy texts. This had a long tradition in Iran. When the original Platonic school closed down, its scholars were invited by the Sasanians to continue their work in Iran, and they remained influential under Muslim occupation, and especially under the early Abbasids. Persian scholars sought to reconcile revelation with Plato and Aristotle. Such intellectual open-mindedness turned Abbasid Baghdad into a world center of learning, so that when the Mongols sacked it in 1258, it was said that the earth ran black with ink and red with the blood of scholars. That was the definitive end of the Islamic Golden Age, but already in the 11th century, the Islamic world started to show signs of the dogmatism that had long become entrenched in Christianity. Al-Ghazali didn't bring this about single-handedly, of course, but he sure played his part. He justified the mystical beliefs of the Sufis, among other things, by stating that human reason was too limited to arrive at truth. Those who thought otherwise were guilty of hubris, according to the man who went by the humble title Proof of Islam. Less funny, however, was that he regarded those who differed with him on essential points of belief not as simply mistaken, but as hidden apostates. Now, renunciation of belief, that was a capital crime. If a Muslim said he was no longer a Muslim, he could be killed for that. Now Al-Ghazali generalized this to people who did call themselves Muslim, but who thought, for example, that only the soul should be resurrected and not the body. Disagree with Al-Ghazali on that, on what he regarded as crucial matters, and according to him, you could and should be killed for that, since for all intents and purposes, you are no longer a true Muslim. Kind of a sneaky way to win an argument, in my view. One of those people who believed all these things that Al-Ghazali considered beyond the pale was Ibn Sina, or Avicenna. Now, he was already dead by that point, so he couldn't be brought to trial for this. But it tells you something, that he was by far the most revered Islamic scholar up to that point. That means that many people thought this way too, and they all should be executed in Al-Ghazali's view. He insisted that he was not against philosophers per se, as long as they accepted his view on these critical issues. But it goes without saying that the wide acceptance of this view was not conducive to intellectual innovation. A precedent had been set. What was perfectly acceptable today could be a capital crime tomorrow. Al-Ghazali's views were extremely influential, perhaps because they were so fitting for the times. From then on, there was less room for rational interpretation, at least in Sunni schools. Within Shiism, rational interpretation would make a comeback with the rise of the Usulis, which we discussed earlier. Because of this, Shiism and Sunnism drifted further apart. Ruhollah Khomeini, who laid the foundations for the current system, was a connoisseur of Greek philosophy, and he was not at all tolerant towards Sufis, whose heyday had long passed by then. One of the ironies here is that Khomeini's Shiite revolution would likely not have happened if a very unorthodox and irrational Sufi sheikh named Ismail had not decided to conquer Iran and convert it to Shiism. As you might remember, Ismail's favorite method of inspiration was the poem. His poems were mostly about how great he was and about his holy mission. His followers would then recite them, so it was perhaps a tool for indoctrination as well. Perhaps a bit like North Koreans have to sing songs about their leaders. Now, the use of poems, that may seem fanciful from a modern Western standpoint, but they were very popular in Iran, and it was a common method of instruction for Sufis. And perhaps not coincidentally. For if a sheikh wanted to talk about something that flirted with the limits of what was permissible, then it might help if he could invoke poetic freedom. The following passage from the famous poet Omar Khayyam shows you what I mean. I apologize for the terrible translation, but not too loudly, for poetry is known to be untranslatable, isn't it? Here's what Omar Khayyam dared to write, quote, "They say that paradise with its houris is good. I say that the juice from the grape is good. Take this money and forget what you are owed. To hear from afar the drums of war, that is good." Unquote. Apart from wine and drunkenness, other favorite topics were villainous behavior, wild dances, and passionate love, not rarely with homoerotic undertones. Most Sufis today would say that all this is to be taken metaphorically. The true object of the poet's love is God himself, surely, and the wine merely symbolizes forgetting oneself. Ismail most certainly did drink wine, but perhaps he was the exception. Now, be that as it may, the essence was to mock people who had their mouths full about upholding the letter of the Quran, but to ignore its spirit, something we can all relate to, no doubt. Just think of the man or woman who sings loudest in church and always sits in the front row, but never stops gossiping and cheating. Now, the Sufis hadn't invented poetry. It was already widely used, and for other reasons besides religious instruction. Not in the least, they helped Iran's pre-Islamic heritage to survive and even thrive during centuries of foreign occupation. No single work was more important in this regard than Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, the Book of Kings. This is one of the longest and best-known works of poetry ever written. It's partly a fantastical epic and partly a pseudo-history of pre-Islamic Persia. It's full of heroes and kings, spectacular battles, promiscuous women, and decadent parties. Now, if I were being naughty, I might notice that these are precisely the kinds of clichés that so-called Orientalists are accused of overstressing. And as it happens, they are also omnipresent in Game of Thrones. Might it not be, perhaps, that sex and violence are simply appealing to just about any audience, wherever or whenever? Now, the Book of Kings was not merely meant to entertain. It carries a clear message, namely, that before the arrival of the Arabs, everything had been far better in Iran, and that Persians should be proud of their ancient past. The main villain in Ferdowsi's book is the Arab invader. He even went so far as to avoid Arab loanwords throughout the whole text. I find that striking, since the Arab invasion was also the early Muslim conquest, of course. The book was commissioned by an Islamic dynasty, namely the Samanids. How to explain this? Well, perhaps first of all, the Samanids were Persians, who broke free from the Arab-led caliphate of Baghdad. To legitimize their position, they intended to install in their subjects the idea that they were separate from the Arabs. And they did this by sponsoring all sorts of art and poetry that celebrated Persian heritage. In this regard, the Shahnameh would be successful beyond all expectations. It still fills Iranians with pride today. Ferdowsi's idea was never to denounce the coming of Islam, just the arrival of the Arabs. Perhaps his main audience were powerful Persian families whose ancestors had held high positions in pre-Islamic times, often as warriors. They had then been forced to serve foreign rulers, to become writers rather than fighters. You see this more often. The longer the samurai of Japan lived in peace, for instance, the more sanguine they became about their martial values. Such people tend to be nostalgic about an idealized past, and the Shahnameh catered to such an audience. Ferdowsi's target audience no longer exists, but the Shahnameh has never gone out of fashion. The story's popularity has survived all the Islamic revolutions that Iran has gone through since. This illustrates that certain rather unorthodox ideas and practices have always remained attractive to a large group of Iranians. Drinking and daring literature are not Western imports like the Ayatollahs would like to claim. They have always been present in Iran, just below or even above the surface. I already explained that things like opium, alcohol, and homosexual relations were pretty common occurrences in Safavid Iran, for instance. The Safavids openly embraced symbols of pre-Islamic Iranian kingship. And what to say about Nowruz, the feast of the Zoroastrian equinox? It was Abbas the Great who popularized it, and it's still celebrated even today under the strict clerical regime. Khomeini disapproved of the widespread fascination for antiquity, unsurprisingly given how the last Shah had tried to present himself as the reincarnation of the heathen kings of old. But to his credit, even Khomeini eventually acknowledged that Iran's cultural heritage, like its ancient ruins, should be preserved. The fact that Iranians today, both young and old, can still recite from such classic poems as the Shahnameh that may reveal why Khomeini thought it prudent to leave the past alone. Few peoples are so proud of their heritage as the Iranians. This was even noticed by Westerners who met some of them during the Qajar era, when it was constantly humiliated left and right. As a fan of history, I of course have to cheer if people treasure their heritage, but every upside has its downsides. It is often noted that many Iranians suffer from a superiority complex and an inferiority complex at the same time. Well, I think this partly explains it. On the one hand, you have centuries of embarrassing decline and crisis. On the other, you have a people that proudly commemorates a past in which Iran was the cultural center of the world. And if you look back even further, as we will, it was once the political center as well. Never mind that this is hardly the same Iran anymore. Now, Iranians are far from alone in this. In many countries, children have to memorize the heroic accomplishments of their ancestors and the lowly betrayals of others. You see it in China, in Japan, in Great Britain. Even tiny Flanders plans to draw up a canonical list of great Flemish achievements, like the invention of French fries, no doubt. So let me get this straight. If some guy from around this area made a beautiful painting one day, I should feel proud because of that. Well, in a way, I could even take credit for it. That sounds rather silly, doesn't it? But I'm afraid it has the potential to become worse than silly. If your country is perfect, but it still has problems, then whose fault is that? It reminds me, again, of soccer fans. I am allowed to mock them, by the way, because I'm one of them. If Kevin De Bruyne scores a goal for Belgium, I rejoice, despite the fact that Kevin doesn't even know nor care that I exist. But what if I took this further? What if I were convinced that the Red Devils have always been the best team in the world, and that the reason they never won a trophy is because they were always robbed? Then every rival team starts to look evil, and any defeat is considered unfair. Perhaps the referee has been bought, or because it may be because the Belgian goalie has a Spanish wife. And before you know it, bam, you're a hooligan. Well, perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself, but you catch my drift. Now, the reason many supporters really do see it that way, I think, is because coaches and managers openly partake in this culture of victimhood, and thereby encourage it. They blame any defeat on the referee or on some dirty trick, because then it's not their fault anymore. Nationalist politicians often behave just like that, I think. And the results can be worse than a soccer riot. So support your team and your country by all means, but don't overdo it, please. You can have too much of a good thing. Just my opinion. So to recapture, perhaps it wasn't so strange that a Sufi cult like the Safavids overtook the lands of Iran when they did. And maybe the same goes for Ismail's peculiar methods and behavior, his drinking, his flouting of Islamic norms, and even his poetry. But what about the forced conversion to Shiism? Well, that too was only possible because of what happened in the previous centuries. First of all, I think it's important to note that the difference between Shiites and Sunnis wasn't the same back in the day as it is now. Shiism originally had strictly political connotations. Being Shiite, that literally meant belonging to the political party of Ali. When early Muslims then defined themselves as Shiite, they simply meant that Ali's family were the rightful leaders of the Muslim community, and that was it. The actual rulers didn't like that, of course, but the acrimony was kept under control because Shiites developed a quietist attitude. They came to understand that they couldn't hope to overthrow the government, so they stopped trying and shied away from politics. Quite often, they would gather far from the centers of power, like the mountains of Iran. At that point, they were essentially a political movement that no longer had any political objectives. What was left amounted to little more than respect for the Prophet's family, something that's never been controversial among Sunnis either. So just to be clear, when I said that under Ismail, Iran turned Shiite, don't imagine people absorbed a complicated set of regulations or a comprehensive belief system. For these to emerge, you needed institutions like the ones that the Safavids would later build. Thereafter, the distinction was sharpened by the political struggle of that increasingly Shiite Iran with its Sunni neighbors. It is to a large degree under the Safavids that Iranians were turned into Shiites as we know them, slowly. That said, there was already a foundation in place on which they could build. In the past decade, there's been a lot of talk and panic about the so-called Shiite revival, from Yemen over Lebanon to Iraq, with Shiite movements like the Houthis and Hezbollah flexing their muscles, all of them allies of Tehran. So no wonder that countries like Saudi Arabia are worried. You might say that this has a precedent in history. The period around the end of the first millennium is known as the Shiite century. It partly overlaps with the so-called Persian intermezzo, by the way. By that time, the Caliph of Baghdad had lost control over his provinces. Governors or emirs still acted as if they were still his loyal subjects, but in reality, it was more like the other way around. In the 900s, it was the turn of the Buyids to dominate Baghdad. They came from the Iranian mountain region called Daylam, and like most people in that area, the Buyids were Shiites. Now, think about what that meant for a second. As Shiites, the Buyids should in theory have considered the Caliph a usurper, right? Instead, they merrily continued the custom of presenting themselves as his servants and, after coming to dominate Baghdad, as his protectors. What a paradoxical situation to put yourself in. By the way, the fact that the Shiite ruler used the leader of Sunni Islam to legitimize his position, that shows you once again just how relative these sectarian differences were at the time. But why did they do it? Well, partly because most people in the region remained Sunni and the Buyids felt no urge to upset them, but also because of what happened in another rich province that had broken free from Baghdad, Egypt. That rich land fell into the hands of the Fatimids, who also happened to be Shiites. Their name refers to Fatima, the prophet's daughter and the wife of Ali. So the Shiites, who had hitherto been the underdogs, suddenly found themselves in control of the two strongest Muslim states. Speaking of a revival, now, you might think that their shared religion would make the rulers of Iran and Egypt allies, but then you would be mistaken. For while the Buyids, in theory, supported the Abbasid caliph, the Fatimids declared their own caliphate in the name of Sevener Shiism. In so doing, they claimed control over all Muslims and over Shia Islam in particular. If the Buyids had accepted this claim, they would have had to subordinate themselves to their Egyptian rivals. They would much rather bow, in air quotes, to the Caliph of Baghdad, who for all intents and purposes was in their custody. Partly to reject the Fatimid claim, the Buyids embraced another form of Shiism, namely Twelverism, the sect which is still dominant in Iran today. In Twelver Shiism, the last imam is supposed to have gone into obscurity. This came in handy for the Buyids because it meant he wouldn't be around to declare his superiority over them. So while the Sunni caliphate was in deep crisis, the Shiites were not united either. The situation much resembles medieval Europe, where you had two popes at some point, each backed and used by a rival king. But the animosity between the two Shiite powers went even further. The Buyids preferred to appoint Sunni and non-Islamic officials rather than Sevener Shiites, while the Fatimids sent aggressive missionaries eastward in search of converts for their sect. We will meet them again later in our story. Now, the Fatimids and the Buyids may have been Shiites, but that didn't mean their subjects were. Unlike the Safavids, they didn't force their beliefs onto the people. They were careful not to provoke the majority of the population. If anything, the region probably became more Sunni in this period because of the large influx of nomads from Central Asia. These had largely adopted Sunni Islam before they arrived. But of course, as the two main Muslim powers were now Shiite, something did change for Shiite believers. They could now openly profess their faith, organize celebrations and processions. Just as importantly, Shiite scholars had all the freedom in the world to debate legal theological issues. The Buyids helped build the first Shia library, while the Fatimids founded a famous university, which is still operational today, though no longer Shiite. Hence, there emerged a solid body of Shiite learning. Had this not been the case, where would the Safavids have found the manpower to enact their religious policies? The Shiite century did not last. The Fatimids would be overthrown by the Sunni court Saladin, after which the Caliph of Baghdad was again recognized in Egypt. The Buyids, for their part, were defeated by the Turks. These new rulers once again craved the blessing of the Caliph, who took the opportunity to make himself relevant again. To this end, and perhaps because he held a grudge against the Buyids, he presented himself as a champion of anti-Shiism. He strived, with some success, towards more coherence within Sunnism. In a way, Sunnism, as we know it, was formed in response and opposition to the development of Shiism, as a way to close ranks, so to speak. This, by the way, is how religions often get their prescriptions, as a means to distinguish themselves from their rivals. The Caliphate's revival would be brief, but its consequences were lasting. For while the Caliph once again became a tool in the hands of the real masters, the Sultans continued the persecution of Shiites in his name. Sunnis and Shiites developed mutually exclusive rituals and dogmas. For example, they celebrated the moment that the Prophet supposedly designated his successor. Ali according to Shiites, Abu Bakr according to Sunnis. It became common Shiite practice to reject the first three caliphs and Aisha, while Sunnis praised them. Thus, the waters between the sects deepened. As late as the 10th century, most Muslims probably wouldn't identify themselves as Sunni or Shiite. But at that point, it was beginning to change. The indoctrination of the Safavids and their struggles with the Ottomans and the Uzbeks speeded up their mutual alienation. Until then, the Shiites remained a persecuted minority. Some managed to preserve their autonomy in isolated regions, like, again, the Iranian highlands. They had to defend themselves, and some indeed became notorious fighters. The most intriguing example, by far, are the remnants of the Fatimid missions to the east, known as the Assassins. They outlasted their former masters, not only because they had clearer rules of succession, but most of all, because they had taken over multiple impregnable mountain fortresses in Iran, and later in Syria too. Not by force, but through stealth. For instance, one commander had the Sultan's permission to build a citadel. But once it was finished, he suddenly declared himself a Sevener Shiite and took it over. Thanks for the castle, now get off my property. Imagine a poor guy who has to inform the Sultan that he had just bought his enemy a great fortress. This was only possible because the Assassins had agents everywhere. There are multiple anecdotes whereby Seveners, from inside the castle walls, orchestrated its capture. As they were seasoned missionaries, the Assassins were clearly masters of propaganda. But their message would only stick because for many locals, the Assassins, and perhaps Shiites in general, were seen as freedom fighters. If only because they defied and opposed the alien domination by the Seljuk Turks. When they became local rulers themselves, their popular appeal diminished. Behind their high walls, the Assassins had managed to hold out for nearly two centuries, which would also be unthinkable if they didn't have plenty of sympathizers in surrounding villages. Their most iconic stronghold was their de facto capital, the fortress of Alamut. On top of a high mountain, it could only be reached through a steep, meandering pass between high cliffs, ideal for ambushes and impossible to reach with siege engines or large forces in formation, and hence very easily defendable. To Game of Thrones fans, this description will certainly sound familiar. But it gets even better. The name Alamut means eagle's nest or eyrie. Yet, as so often, the reality is stranger than fiction. Unlike the Knights of the Vale, the Assassins were not just kept safe by thick walls and high cliffs. They were notorious for their use of political assassinations. Indeed, assassin, that was not a nickname or anything. The word itself entered the English language in referral to these people, so go figure. any leader was brave enough to raise the gauntlet against them became their target. And they didn't just murder their enemies with a poison drink or a sniper rifle. That wasn't their style. No, they did it in the open and dramatically pour décourager les autres. The question automatically comes up, are these the forebears of today's terror groups? Well, no, but it's still interesting to compare the two, I think. There are some parallels. For instance, the assassins too were suicidal in a way. If after several rites of initiation, the Grandmaster honored them by handing them a name and murder weapon, invariably a dagger, then it was considered dishonorable if they survived the attempt. This is interesting, since Islam forbids suicide. Muslims who kill themselves are supposed to go straight to hell. There is a thin line, of course, with putting oneself in a situation from which there is no escape. Little side note, there's nothing particularly Islamic about this. Christ was no fan of killing, and yet the Crusaders shed a lot of blood in his name. Why? Well, because a credible religious leader, in their case the Pope, told them that it would bring them heaven and not damnation. In the assassin's case, it was the Grandmaster who assured them, like a medieval bin Laden, that so many virgins were waiting for them in paradise, if they died fulfilling their task. And they believed him, for as Imam, he could claim supreme insight in Holy Scripture. The assassins were not the forebearers of the Safavids. They were 12 Sevener Shiites after all. But if anything, they clearly showed the military and political potential of the idea of the Imamate. There were other striking resemblances with the current war on terror, like the elaborate safety checks that travelers had to put up with. But the differences outweigh the similarities, I think. Most importantly, you didn't have all these civilian casualties that we associate with today's variety. The assassins' victims came invariably from the highest ranks, caliphs, sultans, viziers, and generals. That they managed to whack such people is just as strange, as hard, as hijacking a plane. It would be as if Al-Qaeda managed to kill George W. Bush, Colin Powell, Barack Obama, and perhaps some US-friendly presidents in the Middle East thrown in for good measure. Their first high-profile victim was Nizam al-Mulk, the powerful vizier who was the driving force behind the so-called Sunni revival. Depending on which sources you believe, this may have gone a bit like when Henry II was angry with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he bellowed, "Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest?" After which knights in his retinue did just that. But if this is more or less how it happened, it seems that the Grandmaster was really satisfied with the result, for it became a proud habit ever since. The assassins were, in my view, more humane than today's terror groups, not only because they made far fewer innocent victims, but also because they recognized that they didn't need to kill to get their way. They preferred their enemies to be terrified rather than dead. For instance, a sultan awoke to the sight of a dagger planted right in front of his bed. Well, the message of that is as clear as can be. They could just as easily have stuck it in his belly, and next time they would. The sultan immediately made peace with the assassins. Imagine if that were ever to happen to the American or Russian president. What do you think? Would they change their policy for fear of their lives? Seems implausible that this would ever occur, but then again, is it really harder to intimidate one man than to fly planes into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center? Who knows, this may even happen a lot. For if it did, I'll bet we'd never hear from it. Now, just to be clear, this is just a bit of fun speculation on my part. I do hope it's plain to everyone listening, I'm not trying to launch yet another conspiracy theory here. Speaking of which, here is another cool story about such intimidation by the assassins. During a negotiation, the Sultan's servants were asked to leave, but the Sultan insisted that two of them stay by his side, for he trusted them completely. They were allowed to hear anything that he said. After which the assassin asked these confidants, "If I ordered you to kill the Sultan right here and now, would you do it?" "Yes, we would," came the firm reply. The Sultan, as you can imagine, stood perplexed. He now understood that he would never be safe, unless he made peace with these people. So he did. Now, I doubt whether this ever happened, but if so, it again shows that the assassins had agents anywhere, and that must mean that their cause was not so unpopular. If they had made as many innocent victims as today's terrorists, I imagine it would have been a different story. Even if the latter episode is largely fictional, I think it still tells you something about the assassins' fearsome reputation. That was such, in fact, that Europeans came to suspect their hand behind political murders in their own lands. The Crusaders, for instance, believed that the Mamluks used them as their hit squad. That was mostly bollocks, but the result was that the word assassin became equivalent with murderer. This is another similarity with a movement like ISIS. Once the group has a certain notoriety, all sorts of atrocities, or accomplishments, depending on your viewpoint, are ascribed to them, often erroneously. Power is in the appearance of power. Even if you are not really capable of striking at someone, if that person thinks you are, you will have power over him. But ironically, the assassin's reputation may have led to their downfall. It was the Mongols that finally did them in. You might think that this was because these were not easy to frighten. After all, no one did terrorism quite like the Mongols. But in fact, it may well have been fear that drove the Mongol Khan to wage war on the assassins. At first, the latter saw the Mongols as useful allies against their longtime Sunni enemies. But these found it easy to convince the Khan that the Grand Master had ordered his death, and that no less than 40 assassins were already on the way. Then again, you could also argue that the Khan would never have had any intention of tolerating such a dangerous people in the middle of Mongol territory, so he may have decided to weed them out at some point anyway. Now, the Mongols were an enemy unlike any that the assassins had ever encountered. They were not quick to give in to threats, and they also had some of the best siege engineers in the world, people who had learned their craft in China. They were more able to knock down castle walls than anyone else, and that was obviously bad news for the assassins. But some places were still too high up in the mountains, and they remained out of reach. So, had the invincible Mongols finally come across something that their armies couldn't handle? Well, in truth, we will never know. For in the end, it was the decisions of one man that decided the assassin's fate. The Grand Master, or the Imam if you will, surrendered the most important castles voluntarily, in the hopes of cutting a deal. Why? His motifs can never be known for sure, but there are fascinating stories about it. It may be that his astrologer convinced him that his defeat was inevitable, and that that's why he wanted to negotiate his surrender. Perhaps. But if you are confronted with an enemy that has defeated every opponent with relative ease, and utterly wiped out anyone who refused to surrender, then you might consider negotiating as well. Whatever his reasons, the Imam asked for a parley, and he received a message that, as a token of good faith, he then had to send a close kin of his, who thence became a hostage. Perhaps for his sake, perhaps for his own, or perhaps out of simple realism, the Imam then gave himself over to the Mongols, on the promise that they would spare him and his family. This they did, at first, because he was still useful to them. They took him to all these different castles so that he, as their lord, could demand that they surrender. And many did, but not all, because they said, a command given under duress, that was not a valid command. At that point, the Mongols decided he had outlived his usefulness and his welcome. In desperation, he pleaded to go see the Khan, and to that end, he traveled all the way to the royal Mongol court, far away on the Eurasian steppe, under escort, of course. Once he arrived at his destination, the Khan rejected his pleas and sent him right back. But he never made it home. Typically, the Mongols subsequently wiped out Sevenner Shiites wherever they found them, surrender or no. In hindsight, it was folly to trust the Mongols at their word, as they were notorious for breaking the terms of surrender, or interpreting them liberally, you might say. For instance, they might promise to spare your life, But as soon as you surrendered, they'd put you in a position that you could never hope to survive, as cannon fodder in the vanguard of their army, for instance. Some assassins managed to flee to the mountains of Syria nonetheless, and there they once again managed to capture some castles. But there, the environment was less welcoming, and the Mamluks managed to subdue them after a while. So in the end, the decisions of one human being drowns the advantage that geography provided. If the Imam had stood firm, who knows what might have happened? If the assassins could withstand the first onslaught, I see little reason why they could not weather the whole Mongol storm the way they had survived in hostile territory for so long. For it must be said, the assassins' surgical terrorism proved no less effective than the modern variety. The longevity of their movement attests to that. The reason for this was because the death of a leader so often led to succession crisis in the Muslim world. With the Mongols, it was no different. In fact, the death of the great Khan, that was the only thing that ever stopped their expansion in its tracks time and again. This was one of the reasons why the assassins had worse luck in Syria. Some of their opponents there, like the Knights Templar, had a solid system of succession. So if one leader was murdered, another quickly took his place. That would have made assassinations less effective. And finally, perhaps most importantly, the Mongols were no more popular than the Turks had ever been, quite on the contrary. So if the assassins had been the only ones left to defy them, this would surely have brought them lots of support. And that might in turn have rendered their creed more attractive. If you're a fan of what-if history, it might be fun to ask what consequences that would have had in the long run. Might the assassins have emerged as the prime power in Iran after the collapse of the Mongols? Well, if so, then Iran might have become Shiite quicker than it did. But it would have been a completely different form of Shiism. Iran, if not the world, would look a lot different then. But then again, if our cat were a cow, we could milk her before the fireplace. It's no good wasting too much time on what-if history. I admit it, this whole excursion about the assassins is a distraction from the purpose of this show. The very reason I do it anti-chronologically is to focus on those things that still have an impact today and ignore all the rest, while the story of the assassins is, for as far as I can tell, a dead end. Then again, one of the problems you could have with the concept of telling history backwards is that it may give the impression that things just had to end up like they did, as if it was all predetermined. The perspective may seem teleological, to use an expensive word. I hope I've managed to avoid that pitfall, but perhaps this means that this small digression on the assassins was valuable anyway, because it helps us recognize that things could easily have gone a different way entirely, that everything may turn on the decision of one human being. And if not, I've enjoyed talking about it anyway. But moving on. For a time, it seemed as if the Mongol conquest would also stop the spread of Persian culture. For unlike the Arabs and the Turks, the Mongols were not eager to embrace Persian civilization. They despised all sedentary peoples, and they only spared what they thought of value. This included artisans and siege weapons. It did not include books and scholars. They also destroyed the fragile irrigation systems that were so crucial to agriculture in mountain regions. Those that were left untouched often fell into disrepair. Cities fell to ruin, farmland became pasture land for the nomads' horses to graze on. And yet, eventually, even the local Mongol horde, the Ilkhans, came round to the attractions of Persian culture. They even became Muslim. This gave both Persian culture and Shiism another lease of life. The Mongols had always been flexible, or rather indifferent, when it came to matters of religion. Like countless others, they recognized that it could be a good idea to co-opt minorities and recruit officials from their ranks. And among these minorities were the Shiites. This yet again offered opportunities for the development of Shiite institutions, although it did nothing to diminish sectarian animosities, of course, which was on purpose, I'll bet. But while they proved adept at the game of divide and rule, the Ilkhans did an even better job at dividing themselves. So much so, in fact, that they utterly wiped out their own dynasty, They were then smoothly absorbed by new Turkic empires, who in turn embraced Persian culture, which could then continue its spread. So to conclude, how coincidental was it that a figure like Ismail could take over and do what he did? The fact that he was a Turkman, that he was the leader of a messianic Sufi cult, that he composed poems and hated Sunnis, and that he would embrace traditional ideas of Persian kingship, all that thus was not out of step with the time and place. In fact, as early as the 1240s, there was a group of Turkish tribesmen that gathered around a mystic, Baba Ishak. This man called himself Rasul Allah, messenger of God. They embraced an extreme form of Shiism and even shared with the later Kizilbash their spectacular red turbans, complete with the 12 folds that symbolize the 12 imams. History rhymes sometimes, clearly. And it also may have a keen sense of ironic humor. Baba Ishak was executed and his movement quashed, but out of its remains grew the Bektashi order, which, ironically, became the cult of the Ottoman Janissaries, the Safavids' great rivals. So time to wrap things up. The period we just described witnessed the rise of Sufism, the blossoming of Persian culture, and the institutionalization of Shiism. Does this matter in the long run? What would come out of these dynamics? Well, the first to give way, perhaps, was Sufism. In times of increasing nomadism, the mystical approach would won points over the jurists and philosophers. But the state builders of the pre-modern era were not so fond of the Sufis' adherence to their own cult leaders. A guy like Abbas the Great supported only one cult, his own. With the dawn of modernity, the tide turned against them even further. As Muslim empires declined everywhere, and with the Christian West clearly on the rise, many clamored to ban irrational influences from Islam in order to better compete with Christianity. The Wahhabis of Arabia are perhaps the best-known example. Since then, Sufism has been under pressure almost everywhere, including in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And yet, there are still plenty of Sufis all over the world. Modernity had its drawbacks and gave rise to counter-movements like Romanticism. Certain Romantics rediscovered the mystical viewpoints of the Sufi scholars of old, and the Iranian Sufi, known as Rumi, is reportedly the most read poet in America today. So Sufism may be on the back foot, but it's far from dead.
What about Persian culture? It is, in a way, miraculous that so much of pre-Islamic Persia survived through so many centuries of foreign occupation. It must be that there is something profoundly attractive about it. As we saw earlier, it was even more influential in medieval and pre-modern times than in antiquity, and remained dominant from Turkey to India until the 19th century. In the introduction to this series, I noted that Iran has immense potential. It's a sleeping giant, a possible regional hegemon even. That may even be a hidden reason why some of its neighbors prefer to keep it down and out. Its potential is not just a matter of oil and gas. For millennia, Iran has been a major soft power. Now, if the country were to escape its isolation, the appeal of its culture might make a comeback. In Turkey, for example, the Ottoman Empire is once again hailed as a shining example these days. This could offer opportunities for a reappraisal of Persian culture. And someday, something similar might even happen in India or Central Asia, even if that seems rather unlikely now. The governments of the stans want to wipe out traces of their Islamic past, while the ruling party of India is not exactly nostalgic for a time of Muslim domination either. But there is one reason to be optimistic about this. The time when Persian culture was dominant throughout the Muslim world, that was also the golden age for Islam at large. So the world's 1 billion plus Muslims have reason to look back on it with pride. Over the past few decades, Arab kingdoms have exercised a lot of soft power in the Middle East. A less isolated Iran could offer a strong alternative. Finally, there is Shiism. In the period we discussed, it became a mature counter-movement with the potential to inspire political and military revolutions. This legacy has arguably proven the most enduring of the lot. We will discuss the history of Shiism more profoundly in the next episode. For now, I want to finish with a shout out to a friend of the show.
I get a lot of emails from no one less than the widow of Muammar Gaddafi. From the title of the mail, I could make out that she wants to spend her late husband's fortune on the podcast. That's real friendly of you, Miss Gaddafi. But if you really want to help the show, just leave a nice review or rating on podcast sites or Spotify. And give your money to Doctors Without Borders or something. For the rest of you, if you'd like to contact me, please understand that I get lots of emails such as these, and I'm rather suspicious in nature. So it's possible that I deleted your message without reading it, for fear that it might be spam. If you didn't get a reply, that is the reason. My apologies. So if you want to reach out to me, please choose your title and first sentence wisely, or send me a text message on Facebook. I'm very grateful for all your feedback and support. Talk to you soon. Bye.